1956 on a expedition of both exploration and conquest. In addition, the Chinese engineers went along, as well as a number of various vassal peoples providing technical assistance. Persians and Muslims were particularly appreciated for their engineering skills. In 1236, the campaign opened with a sweep of the western steppes. These were largely occupied by Kipchak Turks, that is Cumans, and they quickly submitted. By 1236, all the tribes to the Ural Mountains had submitted to Genghis Khan. Many of the Kipchaks were now recruited into the Imperial Army. They eventually become the mainstay of the Western Khanate, the Khanate of Batu, which is later known as the Golden Horde. Late in 1236, Batu, who has excellent information about the political divisions within among the Russian princes, conducts a winter campaign. The army crosses the Volga in force. Subutai leads a column north to ravage the lands of the Bulgar Khans, that is, Bulgar, those Turks on the middle Volga who had converted to Islam back in 921-922. The main force enters onto the South Russian steppes. It crosses the Volga, makes a beeline for the Don, and begins to sweep aside all resistance. At this point, the Russian princes are really stunned. They're not sure what to make of this. Initially, they allow the Mongols the freedom to ravage those South Russian steppes. Furthermore, their memories of the defeat at the Khalkha River had apparently faded. The leading prince at the time was a man named Yuri II, who ruled the city of Vladimir Suzdal, and that principality is effectively the forerunner of the later principality of Moscow. Initially, Yuri II kind of looked with some favor upon the fact that the Cumans were being wiped out on the South Russian steppes in 1236. But that situation changed in the next year. And that year, in the late autumn, early winter of 1237, the Mongol armies now turn their attention north against the Russian cities, which are largely in the forest zone. And as I stressed, the Russian cities are in the taiga, the forest zone, where they've built settlements, they've adopted Orthodox Christianity. The steppes are still largely in the hands of Cumans. There's very little Russian settlement there. We don't have any Cossacks yet. And those people, the Cumans, have submitted to the power of Batu and are now providing forces as well as information about the Russian cities because the Cumans and Russians have constantly been battling along that zone. The famous Vodka Hashish zone I talked about. So in November 1237, the offensives are now opened up against the Russian cities. The first Russian city to get hit is the city of Ryazan. It is fortified with a wooden palisade. The Mongols bring up their Chinese engineers. They storm into the city on December 21 and burn it to the ground. And these Russian cities, once they are torched, they go up immediately because it's largely timbered construction, and the only major buildings are the Orthodox churches, which are an adaptation of Byzantine art. Well, at that point, Prince Yuri II realized these guys are not in for just attacking the nomads. This is a serious invasion, and he tries to raise a coalition of other Russian princes. And as in all Russian coalitions, the vast majority of the princes decide to sit it out, defend their own towns, and let Yuri do most of the fighting. Yuri suffers two major embarrassing defeats. The first one on the last day of Lent in 1238. Batu's army just runs through the Russian army. They show up at Vladimir Suzdal. They put the city under siege. It's captured and slaughtered. Most of the royal family goes down. Yuri tries to rally his army. He fights a second battle. He's wiped out in early March of 1238. And then, starting from that point on, from 1238 running into 1239, the Mongol army reduces and destroys virtually every major Russian city. There is very little opposition. The princes all defend their own towns. There's no effort to meet the Mongols in open battle. That is seen as suicide, but equally insane is trying to defend the cities individually because Batu just brings up the Chinese engineers and the cities are immediately reduced and the populations are slaughtered. The medieval chronicles speak of repeated massacres of population, some deportation of artists, artisans, some of the female population. But on the whole, the cities of Russia suffer a major destruction. And most of the early churches built in the aftermath of the conversion to Christianity are essentially gone. Batu then retires to the steppes that he's conquered, the South Russian steppes, and he finds the region of the lower Volga particularly congenial. As you recall, this was the nucleus of the earlier Khazar Khanate. It was probably the nucleus of the of a number of Cuman tribes. And in time, Batu's heirs will settle and build a new city, a tent city that emerges into a settlement on the Volga known as Sarai, which is a Mongolian word for palace. At this new encampment, Batu begins to collect information about what's farther west. He has now brought all of the steppes under control, probably everything up to certainly the Dnieper, probably to the Dniester River. The Russian cities have been thoroughly sacked. The only cities to escape were Novgorod and Pskov, which are so far north in the swamps and the winters and the forest that they're not even worth going after at this point, and they can essentially be safely ignored. And at this point, historians question, well, what were Batu's motives next? I mean, he's conquered the Western steppes. He's got his khanate. Well, we're not really told exactly what Batu had in mind. This has to be inferred from the sources, and most of these are straightforward narrative. But at this point, Batu had under his command probably over 150,000 men. He could put together field armies of 30,000 for fast, or 20,000 for fast-moving columns. And Batu took it upon himself to move next into Central Europe. Now, again, I think this was just part of his carrying out the commission to extend Mongol power as far west as the hooves of the Mongolian horses will ride. And his knowledge of what went beyond those Russian steppes was probably pretty vague. He did know there was a Christian Europe. He had probably reports of something like a pope, whom he thought was sort of like the strange Chinese, a Western version of the Chinese emperor with the mandate of heaven. But the immediate cause came down to Cumans, who had escaped into the Kingdom of Hungary and into Galicia, which today would be southern Poland and southwestern Russia, and had found refuge, particularly with King Bela IV of Hungary. And this was the excuse to push west. It was a pretext. The first thing that Batu does is carry out a pacification of the last Russian city, that is Kiev. That city was the only city that had not fallen into Mongol hands, and it was on the main route leading into Galicia, that is southern Poland. And so the city of Kiev was put under siege. The garrison appealed to help. It's actually a possession of a fellow called Daniel of Galicia, Duke. He's not able to support the city. Assistance is summoned from King Bela of Hungary. He's too busy with his own problems. And the result is Kiev falls, and there is another massacre and sack. And Kiev was regarded as the most beautiful city in Russia, the mother of Russian cities. Princely families and the great families of Kiev had intermarried with many of the European nobility and royal families. Most of Central Europe was somehow linked to the city. It was seen as a shock and a warning as what was to come next. And what came next was, again, the typical Mongol winter campaigns. With Kiev captured, Batu gains forces from Ogatai. More forces arrive from the east. He refits his army. And then he's ready in 1241 to launch an invasion into Europe itself, beyond the steppe zone. Two great attacks are envisioned. The first one is an attack into southern Poland that will lead the Mongol armies into Silesia and ultimately into Germany and Central Europe. That command is given to Subutai with various Mongol princes, and its mission is to prevent the forces of Poland, of Silesia, the Teutonic Knights, from joining up with King Bela in Hungary. And the second objective is, of course, King Bela of Hungary. So in February of 1241, Subadai crosses the frozen Vistula and enters into Poland. The Mongol army splits up into columns, completely outmaneuvers its opponents. One force led by a lovely name, his name is Duke Boleslav the Chaste of Krakow. His army is essentially wiped out. Krakow is abandoned and torched. The other army is commanded by Duke Henry II, Henry the Pious of Silesia. He runs smack into a Mongol army at the city of Liegnitz, by its German name, Liegnitz, which is in Silesia. Today it's part of Poland. And that army is decisively defeated in April of 1241. It is a total romp on the part of the Mongols. King Henry is actually thrown from his horse. His head is cut off. Nine sacks of ears are collected to count the dead. Essentially, Subutai and those princes have done their job. They've neutralized any kind of support from Poland and the eastern nobles of the Holy Roman Empire. The result is Subutai crosses over the mountains of Galicia and descends Hungary from the north. Meanwhile, Batu has set in motion the main Mongol army in four major columns. It crosses into Hungary. King Bela is taken by surprise, and the Mongol forces sweep across the Pannonian steppes or grasslands, and they find most of Hungary really very congenial. It's essentially grasslands. There's no real fortresses. And in April of 1241, the Hungarian army of Bela IV and the Mongol army under Batu take up positions for a great battle. Bela IV fortified his camp near the modern city of Mohi. And what happened is Bela IV tries to secure the strategic bridge by a night maneuver on the night of April 1st, April 10th and 11th in 1241. His forces secure the bridge, they alert the Mongol army, and Batu moves up quickly, drives the garrison off the bridge on the dawn of April 11th, and then the army marches 5 miles to surprise the camp of Bela IV, who's still readying his army, thinking that he has control of the bridge and he can march his army out, cross the bridge, and fight the Mongols on the east bank of the river. The result is an absolutely ferocious battle. The Hungarian knights distinguish themselves. Bela IV fights on. Eventually, they break out and flee to the city of Buda and points west. The Mongols slaughter a good deal of the Hungarian infantry that panics, but the fighting is heavy. Mongol losses were very significant. And furthermore, Batu encounters something that he had not really seen before. As the Mongol army moves west across the Hungarian plains, they run into fortified masonry castles. And Batu has just outrun not only his geographic knowledge, but his logistical limit. And that means that for that Mongol army to move forward into Central Europe, you're going to need a very different kind of army. You're going to need more than just some Chinese engineers. You're going to need large numbers of infantry, and you're going to need engineers who have the expertise to take masonry castles. And in effect, Central Europe, medieval Europe, poses the same problem that Sung China poses. You have outrun the steppe zones. If you're going to conquer this sedentary civilization, you need to create a new and different army that can operate in tandem with the Mongol forces. So Batu really was at a loss, probably, of what to do next. What happened is the problem was solved for him. In 1242, after having ravaged Hungary for most of 1241, Batu pulled his army back to the Lower Volga because he heard news that his uncle, Ogedai, had died on a hunting expedition on December 11th, 1241. And that meant a new election. And Batu was very keen to be in on the election of the next Khan. He was not on the best of terms with some of his relatives, and he wanted to make sure he had a decisive voice in the upcoming election. And for the first time, but not for the last, the dynamics, the politics at the Mongol court would determine expansion. And Western Europe was essentially spared a return of the Mongol army because of the succession issues at the Mongol court.
Lecture 30, Mongol Invasion of the Islamic World.
In this lecture, I plan to look at the Mongol invasions into the Islamic world, and we're going to concentrate on the campaigns of Hulagu, who was the brother of Kublai Khan, actually the older brother of Kublai Khan. I want to make two important points to tie this lecture to the previous lecture. In the previous lecture, we discussed how Batu, the grandson of Genghis Khan, had commanded a great army that overran the Western steppes, invaded Russia, Hungary, and Poland. That invasion had been cut short by really dynastic politics back at Karakorum, the Mongol capital in the homeland. December 11th, 1241, the great Khan Ogedai died, and that resulted in Batu halting his invasion. And I mentioned that for the first time, dynastic politics influenced imperial policy. This lecture will show the same feature. When we discuss the Mongol invasion of the Islamic world, and the decision was taken as early as 1253, the main conquest occurred between 1257 and 1260. The ultimate plan of this invasion, which was to take Cairo, was also cut short by dynastic politics. And that actually plunged the Mongol Empire into the First Civil War. In addition, both campaigns bear another important resemblance that you should keep in mind as we discuss the operations in the Islamic world. In both Central Europe, in Hungary and Poland, as well as in the Middle East in this upcoming lecture, the Mongols essentially hit their logistical limit. They moved into areas where they would have to alter their way of warfare, devise new strategies, new logistics, and literally create a new army to accompany the traditional steppe cavalry if they were to operate in Egypt or in Central Europe. They will face the same barriers when they try to conquer China, and they overcome the barriers in China, but they never have the time or the opportunity to do so, to return to the Middle East and to Central Europe. So it is important to keep both of these thoughts in mind about the dynastic politics, the limits of Mongol logistics, strategy, and even knowledge in waging the war against the eastern lands of Islam. Now, let's back up a moment and recall what the situation was at the death of Genghis Khan in 1227. Genghis Khan had carried out one of the most remarkable invasions of all times by the nomadic armies of the steppes. He had planned an audacious campaign that had swept through the cities of Transoxiana in Iran, had overthrown the empire of Khorasan, had literally hunted and hounded down that ruler, Muhammad Shah, who died a miserable exile on an island in the Caspian Sea. The victories were spectacular, but so were the atrocities and the massacres that accompanied the conquests. And the result was, when Genghis Khan slowly returned home to his capital at Karakorum, he left behind him a largely devastated Islamic world. There are many anecdotes indicating that on his return, that Genghis Khan was rather impressed by Islamic teachers, imams. He is credited with making favorable comments about Sufi mystics, although this idea of a pilgrimage to Mecca completely escaped him, and he always thought, well, Mongol law, the Yasa, the traditional customs, trumped everything. But he wasn't necessarily hostile to Islam as a religion, so long as it knew its place, which was as one of many faiths within the Mongol Empire. But he left little in the way of an administration. There was no real effort to revive the cities. to put agricultural land back under production. There had been widespread devastation in some of the cities. And it really was Ogaday, the second Khan, who began to put in a rudimentary administration. That largely was stationing a Mongol army at Tabriz in the region today known as Azerbaijan. And as I mentioned, Azerbaijan was part of a set of steppes in northwestern Iran that was very congenial to Mongols and Turks. It provided grasslands. It had historically been attractive to nomads. And the Mongol military force, and most of those guys were actually Turks, they weren't Mongols, were stationed there to provide protection for the regions of Iran and Transoxiana, which had been brought under Mongol control. It was that army in 1243, shortly after Ogaday's death, that invaded Asia Minor and clobbered the Sultan of Konya and brought Asia Minor, most of Asia Minor, under the tutelage of the Mongol Khan. Ogaday had died. That was actually during the regency of this very, very formidable lady known as Turegene, who is the actually the widow of Ogaday. So the situation in the Islamic world was really one of no functioning Mongol administration, a great deal of devastation. And on the other hand, there were counter-authorities in the Islamic world that were perceived as dangers to Mongol rule. That included the Abbasid caliphs in Baghdad, who were a powerful regional power, the Assassins, that famous Ishmaelite sect at their fortress Alamut, the so-called Eagle's Nest, and above all, the Mamluk, the slave sultans of Egypt. In 1241, 1242, as I mentioned, the Mongol Empire was in a crisis, and this was brought about by the death of Ogaday. Hostile sources say that Ogaday drank himself to death. He was known for his indulgence, his extravagant expenditures. He was not popular in his later years. And that death, which occurred on December 11th, 1241, was quickly communicated by the courier system across the Eurasian steppes to Batu, where the majority of the Mongol nation was battling in Hungary. Batu knew early in 1242 there would be a new election. And as I mentioned before, the nomadic peoples practiced what is called lateral succession. It was by no means assured who was going to be elected the next Khan, or to be more accurate, the Great Khan. That is, who would succeed to the position of Genghis Khan. And in 1242, there were two candidates. The leading candidate was Güyük, the son of Ogaday, who had a reasonable claim to the throne. Furthermore, his interests were pushed by his mother, the widow of the great Khan, Turegene, and she was a powerful and formidable lady who was going to put her son on the throne. There were other candidates. I mean, Batu himself was a potential candidate. He, after all, was the son of the older son of Genghis Khan, who had died in 1227, months before Genghis. And then there was the family of the second son of Genghis Khan. That was the family of Jagatai. There was also the family of the youngest son, Toluai. Toluai had died in 1232. So there were a number of candidates available. And in 1242, only one of the four sons of Genghis Khan was still alive. That was Jagatai, who ruled the central steppes. He had a number of sons. He was too old. He was an important elector in the events, but he himself was not a candidate. The other candidates came down to Batu, who was in the west with the majority of the army. But as you recall, his father, Jokhi, was not really Genghis Khan's son. He was probably son by a Merkit prince and the wife of Genghis Khan, Berte, when she was in captivity, although Genghis had always treated him as a son. Batu had a lot to recommend him. He had command of the Western armies. The other possible candidates were the sons of Toluai, the youngest son. Toluai had died in 1232, but he and his wife had four sons, all capable of obtaining the Khanate. And that included the eldest, Mengke, who eventually would become Khan, and then his brothers, Hulagu, Kublai, the later Kublai Khan, and the youngest brother, a fellow by the name of Ara, Berke. So there were plenty of candidates. The election didn't take place until years after the death of the great Khan. It wasn't until 1246 when the electors decided to go with Ogedai's son, Güyük, who was elected the great Khan and acclaimed by all the peoples who dwell within the felt tents. And the reason for the delay was not communications, but maneuvering the electors to come to that consensus at the assembly, at the Kurultai. And as I mentioned, this was not a democratic assembly where you debate it and vote it. Everyone more or less knew who was supposed to be elected. It would be an acclamation and a great religious event. Well, that change in leadership also changed policy, because the new Khan, Güyük, was very, very hostile to Batu. There were rumors that he wanted to poison Batu. And furthermore, Güyük did not want to renew the Western campaigns, because that would bring a distinction to Batu. Batu, therefore, aligned himself with the widow of Toluwi, the youngest son of Genghis Khan, and his cousins. And those four sons had a just as domineering and powerful and remarkable mom as Güyük did. Her name is Sorgaktani Beki. Sorgaktani Beki was probably the favorite daughter-in-law of Genghis Khan. And her two sons that were the apple of her eye, that was the second and third, Hulagu and Kublai, the future Kublai Khan, they were also favorite grandsons of Genghis Khan. And eventually they would get their day in 1248 when Güyük died prematurely, and the eldest of those four brothers, Mengke, would be elected Khan. Now, these machinations, and they're really lurid politics. There's accusations of poisoning. Batu threatened civil war at one point. These machinations underscored the instability of nomadic traditions of lateral succession. Also, the rivalry in the third generation from Genghis Khan. All of these cousins had equal claim to the great Khan. And if they didn't get the great the job great Khan, they expected to get an ulus, that is, a people. An ulus is still an important word in both Mongolian and Turkish. That is a huge area with nomadic tribes and military power. And in addition, either the commission to attack a sedentary civilization that would provide tribute, or control of an area that had already been conquered, such as the Russian principalities, northern China, or Transoxiana. And this basic instability would eventually break out into civil war, and in time would lead to the unraveling of the empire of Kublai Khan. The second important election came on July 1, 1251, when, again, the Mongols decided to choose a new Khan, and that was Mengke, the eldest son of Toluwi. And that meant that the power of the great Khan, the position of the great Khan, now passed from Ogedai's family, and Ogedai was the third son of Genghis Khan, to the family of the youngest son, Toluwi. That was an important change, because Mengke cut a very, very different image from his cousin and from his uncle, that is, Ogedai and Güyük. For one, he had none of these pretensions of being a Chinese-style monarch.